I'm Jason Michael Perry, the man with three first names, and this is Thoughts on Tech and Things. Technology moves fast. Policy does not. Right now, AI is reshaping how we work. Autonomous cars are ready to hit the road. And humanoid robots are moving from the show floor to the factory, as well as in our homes. But in state houses and Capitol Hill, regulators are still trying to figure out the rules. What's the policy? And my guest today has been at the center of this tension for over 35 years. Gary Shapiro is with the Consumer Technology Association. This is the organization behind CES, the Consumer Electronics Show. And as CEO and executive chair, he has testified before Congress more than 20 times. He's also the author of a new book called Pivot or Die. And we had the chance to sit down at CTA's headquarters in Crystal City for a conversation about what it means to pivot in business and technology and in your own personal life. So let's get into some headlines that frame the conversation. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Invested in AI but not seeing results? You're not alone. Perry Labs helps organizations figure out what's working and what's next. Start with our AI assessment at perrylabs.io.
Got a baby on the way? It's time for Hoopty. I'm Roxy Aldrew, Baltimore-based inventor of Hoopty Hoops, NFC-enabled silicone rings that turn any baby bottle into a smart device. Just tap to sync your bottles with our free app. Hoopty tracks your bottles, calculates expiration, and sends reminders so you never waste a drop. Shop gethoopty.com. That's GETHOOPDEE.com and use the code THOUGHTS20 for 20% off.
Are you missing out on customers without even realizing it? For public venues like airports and sports stadiums, accessibility is more than a checklist. It's a competitive edge. That's why organizations partner with Raboca to ensure their spaces are accessible for the 25 million Americans living with low vision. Visit Raboca.com. That's Reboka.com for details.
The path to growth shouldn't stop at the border. The World Trade Center Institute provides the connections, knowledge, and global network Maryland's most ambitious leaders need to scale. From executive development to international trade, we help our region's businesses thrive on the world stage. Start your global journey at WTCI.org. If you live in Maryland and you're waiting for a Waymo to give you a ride, you're going to have to wait a little bit longer. Maryland's legislation has decided to end without authorizing autonomous vehicles to operate on the state's roads. Waymo has been doing manual driving tests in Baltimore since December. Waymo made the case that their data shows that autonomous vehicles are involved in 90% fewer serious crashes compared to human drivers, and this is after 127 million miles of operation by their vehicles. But lawmakers, they're not ready. The bill didn't make it through before the session closed, and so now we have to wait. And this isn't just a Maryland story. Waymo is pushing for similar legislation in DC and in states across the country. The tension is that the technology is moving faster than the policy, and the regulations allow it to be deployed and used. On the AI side, the White House has released a national policy framework just this March that attempts to preempt state AI laws. The administration is pushing to avoid a patchwork of regulations. The goal, one set of national rules, not 50 different ones. But it's also given the Department of Justice a task force that will challenge state AI laws that the administration considers unconstitutional or overly burdensome. While the U.S. is working to figure this all out, the race with China is getting more intense. DeepSeek, the Chinese AI startup that shook global markets last year with its models, just dropped a new version. And that model, that new version, is very competitive. DeepSeek says it falls only marginally behind the best new frontier models from OpenAI and Google, just trailing by maybe 3 to 6 months. And here's the kicker. It costs a fraction of what American models currently charge. So all of these threads, policy, competition, and the speed of change are a big part of my conversation with Gary Shapiro. So let's get into it. My guest today has spent more than 35 years at the center of the technology industry. Gary Shapiro led the Consumer Technology Association, the organization behind CES, the Consumer Technology Show, every year in Vegas, first as CEO and now as executive chairman. Over that span, he's transformed CES into one of the most important technology stages on the planet. He's testified before Congress more than 20 times on issues from AI to intellectual property, and most recently wrote the book Pivot or Die, How Leaders Thrive When Everything Changes. We're here today at CTA's headquarters in Arlington, Virginia, in the studio. So, Gary, thank you. Welcome. And also, thank you for welcoming us into your home.
Well, thank you for making the trip to Arlington, Virginia, our global headquarters.
Oh, I appreciate it. So I'm going to start off with your book. And I'm still early in the book. But what I did appreciate about Pivot or Die is that it starts off with COVID. And in the story that really stuck with me is that while everyone can relate to COVID, you were forced to move the biggest conference ever and take that conference with more than 140,000 attendees, thousands of exhibitors, 2.5 million square feet of floor space, and figure out how do you do it virtually. And you had to make that call early, which I think, 7 months early, I think it is. And I'm just wondering, like, when we talk about pivoting, that's one of the biggest pivot points. What was that decision like?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I'm glad you raised that, because COVID was the big pivot for the world that we all experienced together. Right. But that specific decision was very controversial in the world of those people that put events on, because no one had canceled an event 7 months out. Yeah. And, you know, at that point, President Trump was talking about this will be over by Easter and, you know, things like that. But we saw it coming. We made a decision kind of early on. We were still socializing as staff, and our board finalized it. But we were there that we had to cancel, because the investment the companies make is so huge in the exhibits and the planning and the contracts and hotels and entertainment and the flying, that we wanted to give them as much notice as possible. And there was no way there would be a vaccine that publicly available in terms of broad public reach that would be there in time for the show. So we just made a very logical thing that this makes no sense. And we spoke to all our partners ahead of time in Las Vegas, and they were all very understanding, and not one of them said, well, but our contract says, and this really isn't in force majeure, an act of God, because it hasn't happened yet. And you're supposed to wait till it happens. And I thought that would be foolish. So we took a calculated risk and did what we thought was the right thing for everybody, so that hotels and convention centers could plan as well. And we went digital, and then not only did we go digital, but we had to go to find vendors, and no one had ever tried anything of that scale to try to do it. We ended up with Microsoft, because they're a member of ours, they're a good customer, they understood, they had Microsoft Teams, they're very good on cybersecurity, their headquarters. We later learned, when we actually did this, that they had a backup generator, which actually went into effect because there was a storm the night before we were going live. And they didn't even know they had a backup generator. And it worked. It all worked. And a lot of good things happened. Going back and forth from Microsoft to prepare for that was very interesting. But they, you know, trying to do stuff in a large group setting and get keynotes done ahead of time and interviews. It's actually some ways easier, because you could interview almost anyone. They were willing to do a Zoom call interview. But doing live stuff, we took calculated risks. And it worked out well. But you could look at the world two ways. You could say, this is a terrible thing that happened, or you could say, wow, there's tremendous change, which means tremendous opportunity. And the opportunity we had as a world was to do things differently, to do remote work, to learn about different ways of communicating.
And when you were early, I mean, this is the thing I think about living on the frontier, is that because you made that call early, as I can remember it, there were a lot of large conferences that followed your lead, but also learned from some of the things that you did. I mean, this is innovation in a lot of ways, of taking something as huge as CES is and turning it into a virtual format.
Yeah, but I don't want to overstate how great it was, because it wasn't great, to be perfectly honest with you. It was extremely difficult, and one of the great lessons, I think, at the CEO level, from people I speak to, CEOs around the world, is that they all of a sudden focused on trade shows as entities and other events, where you have to be face-to-face with people. And I think they were very frustrated, because most CEOs have a big part of their job, which is dealing directly with people. And I think it was very frustrating for them. And while the CFOs, after all this whole tragedy of COVID, were like, oh, wow, look at all the money we saved not traveling, the reality is you need that live, face-to-face, five-sense experience where serendipity rules and things matter, and you can discover people, discover relationships. And we're still seeing the benefits of that. Is that now there's more and more opportunities for all staff to get together and work in an exhibit. There's opportunities there for discovery. There's opportunity for new customers to strengthen existing. And all of a sudden, at the very top levels of major corporations around the world, these events are greatly appreciated. CFO still, you know, forget the travel. And although I'm the paid cheerleader for the technology industry. And I believe in the power of technology to do a lot of great things. It is not a great substitute for the fundamental human experience we need to be. Like, you're doing this sitting here with me. And it's so much more meaningful that we're together than just doing this the way some of our interviews
go. That's something I hear from a lot of business owners. It's that the time that it's taken to get back from virtual to being in person for events, physical events, the Zoom events, the Zoom webinars, they're just not the same thing. They're not a replacement. And for a moment, that was there, but, and I'm going to go on a big tangent here for a moment, but when you look at people who are trying to figure out what their next job is, careers, and being in person, physical, makes a difference.
And when you experience, you do. We are human beings. We need other human contact. And the information you can get from a computer about someone, even with a great Zoom call or Teams call, is very limited because you're not getting the full sense of what the person's saying. You're not having an opportunity to have a drink or share a meal. It's much more difficult just to discover what you don't know. The joy of an event like CES or other trade shows is the serendipity you are discovering. You're being inspired. If you think about what innovation is two ideas coming together which produce something that people find value in. And the way you do that in an efficient way at a trade show or a convention or a meeting is you have a lot of people and you create an environment, a catalyst, where that innovation and ideas can grow and also do it in an inspiring way. And there's nothing more inspiring to me than events like CES, where you could go and see what's out there. We have over 4,000 exhibitors, almost 150,000 people from around the world, over 7,000 journalists. And you just walk around and say, I can't believe you could do that. And if you do it, and people, even journalists, are coming back, they're saying they get enough story ideas and interviews for several months. So it's a very, very efficient way. There was one highlight moment that occurred for me many years ago when the CEO of Intel, I ran into him the last day of the show and he was carrying his own suitcase, which really impressed me. And he said, I just want to thank you because I got more done in these 4 days. I met more people from around the world than I could have traveling around for 6 months.
So I have to, of course, ask you about the biggest pivot that's happening right now. One of the reasons that I found your book so timely is that we are living through, I think, the biggest transition or thing that has ever happened, which is AI, artificial intelligence. And when we think about this pivot to AI, it's such a fundamental change in how we work, how we make decisions, how businesses operate, and it's one of the biggest disruptors. So when I was reading your book, you talk about the four types of pivots. And in those four types of pivots, I think the startup pivot, the force pivot, the failure pivot, and the success pivot. Can you explain how those are different? And also, when it comes to AI, what type of pivot do you think that we're in? What type of pivot do you think businesses are dealing with right now?
Well, you're right about AI. I agree with you. It is a fundamental change, and it's happened super quickly. Like, if you look at the telephone, and it took like 25 years to get where we are with AI, or even some of the internet itself, which was a huge pivot for the world, in terms of creating business, creating opportunities, but also creating fears. We have certainly lived through technology that's come along in a way it's almost logarithmic, the increase in the pace of change, but there's similarities in going back for every new technology because it's inspired great possibility, but also people as human beings love the status quo. I mean, that's how we grow up. We start, you know, with our families and everything is like you want it to be the same, but life changes around you and you're not going to stop it. So you have to adjust. And it's a little bit of Darwinism there. It's not the strongest or the fastest, it's the quickest who can adapt. And that's true in the business world. And when you talk about the four types of pivots, they're each different. Certainly, as startups have an advantage over bigger companies. They could move super quickly, and they could jump onto a rapidly changing time like this, where you're seeing more like startups going massive, like almost overnight. It's because of the technology of AI that allows that. The success pivot is especially one of my favorites, is that the problem with success is you think you're really smart when you're successful. And the other problem is almost every company has one great product they make all their money on. It's the biggest thing they do. And they carry them. So every new thing they do is like, first of all, it'll never get big enough, quick enough to satisfy what the old thing is. And Steve Jobs figured it out. He created a Skunk Works, and that's how he dealt with it as a big company. And he recognized that, and that's how he kept pivoting and growing Apple. And others have done that as well. But generally, that's the fact that it takes so long and the big companies are slow allows those startup pivots. The failure pivot is one where you don't have a choice, really. Like, you're going down and you know it. But I've seen there's a lot of denial when companies are going down because there's things you could do when you start going down where you could either sell out, You could change, you could partner, you could do joint ventures, you could save your value. But what I more often see is if people are in denial, they're stuck with this idea and they can't give it up because either the idea hasn't worked or they haven't executed, or it's just not a good idea, or life has changed around them, or everyone else saw it was a good idea, and there's no real barriers or moats to get into that product or field or service, and so they don't adapt. There's different types of pivots, but generally I think what the book tries to do, though, is offer advice, not only in business, but in life. And it's something that, you know, especially as I go on in my career, I'm giving a lot of people advice because they're asking for it. It just happened at lunch today with a large association executive asked for advice about what I would do in her position. And I am finding myself mentoring people a lot. But what I do think for younger people especially, the things that they just are traumatized over, it's like, what college do I go to? Or what do I do when I graduate high school? And then it's like, what's my first job? And those are big decisions, but you know what? They're not that important in the scheme of things because a lot of it is randomness and who you meet. But the important decisions in life, there's only really four. It's like if you get a partner in life, you know who that partner is. If you have kids, which is like a lifetime commitment. If you commit a felony and if you do something unsafe. Everything else, you know, you're learning about yourself in a sense. So when you go to school, you need to figure out what it is that turns you up, what wakes you up that you look forward to, what's your passion, and how do you turn that into work? And then in terms of who you meet, which affects your life, a lot of it is randomness. There are ways to meet people and meet your lifetime partner, and it's good if you have something in common with them, like whether it's sports, sporting teams, or sports itself, or hobbies, or whatever. And those things help relationships last, but in reality is, you know, these are decisions that are, I don't think you should be allowed to be married until you're 30. That's, you know, you don't know yourself yet, you know? So, and I see a lot of shaking heads.
I agree with that. I think that what's interesting about that is the psychology of pivoting, right? We are, like you said, attuned to be afraid of change, to be afraid to do something different. And it's the thing that I think makes it so interesting about this moment with AI, with the adoption rates that we see with technology, certain technologies, is that it's sometimes hard to get people to say, yeah, I want to try this thing out. I want to take a risk. I want to do a thing. And it's a big separation because adapting is scary, right? I mean, that sounds like exactly what you're saying.
Exactly. Exactly. It is true that it's more comfortable to do what you've done before. So you have to realize it's discomfort. It's like going on the stage. If you're not a little nervous when you go out on stage, that's great. That's not normal. But if you are nervous, if you can challenge that this nervousness is good, it'll make me perform better on stage, that's a way of harnessing it. Same thing with anything you do that's different. I mean, like my mother used to listen to the radio talk shows all the time. I say, Mom, why are you wasting your time? She says, Gary, if I could learn one thing from this in an hour, it's worth it. So I was like, brought up like, you have to keep learning your whole life and adapting. And that's really important. It's not like you just, you know, graduate and get your degree at school and you're done learning. You're learning all the time. And you'll never, the more you learn, realize you less you know. And that's important. But if you keep learning, and you also learn from failures. Anytime anything bad happens in my life, a failure, or people go, look, even a relationship, you think, what did I learn from this? And that's the important thing. That's why is the opposite of, or the counter to that, in a sense, is success breeds overconfidence and arrogance, and you think you're brilliant. Well, failure actually is your learning moment in your life. Every time you've ever failed at something, that's when you've learned the most. And that's how you could make yourself feel better. Well, at least I'm learning something at this horrible moment.
I 100% agree with that. I think I've learned the most through many failures in life, but they've also, those are the things that are the catalyst to figure out how do you change, what do you do, or help you learn. And like, we're all lifetime learners. So this moment, you have members of some of the biggest consumer organizations in the world. And you were just speaking about someone who's a trade association leader. I wonder when you look at the moments of mass disruption, you know, we talked about COVID, one of the biggest disruptions that I can think of in the world. I know that you're here for the internet and the web, one of the biggest disruptions. Now AI and the disruption is a big disruption. What are the types of things that you hear business leaders or that you talk with business leaders about and how they prepare to, I mean, I guess the best word is to pivot, right? Or die.
Maybe. Well, I think that there's a culture among successful people of pivoting, actually, yeah, and adapting to change. And the more I've gotten to know a lot of CEOs.
It's like a muscle, maybe, huh?
You don't become a CEO of a successful company without learning how to pivot. I mean, there's probably some examples in the tech world where very extremely inexperienced younger people, you know, they did one thing that was great and they thought even carrying it. But generally, you know, what we see, for example, in the tech world, speaking of pivoting and risk-taking, is we see a lot of immigrants. And they've made the risk already in their lives by immigrating here. It's a big risk, the new culture, often a different language, giving up family. So that starting and taking business risks is not that big a deal for them. And they're willing to do that. And it's striking to me how so many of our tech companies are formed by immigrants or children of immigrants. And it's true statistically with research, it shows how much immigrants are willing to take risks. There are a lot of the entrepreneurs. It's why a lot of what's going on in terms of pushing out our immigrant community, who's not here, I guess, legally for the long run, but that's affecting not only our ability to innovate, but it's also affecting, you know, we have this great manufacturing push in the U.S., and yet even we're kicking out the workers, and we have Americans that are not doing it. And when I go and talk to our members around the country, they say, love to manufacture in the U.S. Show me where the workers are, because they're not available. You know, they say, we'll train someone for 3 months, and in certain areas of the country, 70% of them will leave within the first 3 months after they're hired. They say, we can't find the workers. That's one of the reasons we manufacture overseas. And of course, there's the cost of workers, there's the cost of health care that manufacturers bear here, or in other countries, that's borne by the government. There's a lot of different reasons that go into this thing, and our big risk as a country right now is we are basically starting to put up a digital wall around the country for a lot of reasons. Some of it's called national security, it's called tariffs, it's called not letting people in come visit, which is, you know, the travel industry is being decimated by our own country at this point because a lot of people don't like us. There's rumors about what's going on. I mean, there's so many things we're doing wrong as a country right now that is discouraging our own economy. CEOs can't plan anymore, because they don't know what's going to happen, because they don't know what a range of tariffs are, they don't know where they get the workers from, they don't know what the next administration or Congress will do, and there's no, if you want businesses to succeed, you need a certain level of predictability from your government. You can't have contingency planning going, you know, 96 different ways. And that's where we are today. And it is a fundamental concern for me in the country.
It feels like a lot of consistent chaos. And it reminds me that as much as I like to think of CTA as CES, that a big part of your organization is focused on advocacy for consumer businesses and technology. And I don't know if I have the number right, but I think in the beginning I said 20 plus times that you have sat in front of Congress to talk about everything from autonomous vehicles to tariffs to, you know, to AI. I'm curious, and I'm going to start off, I have like two or three questions here. But first off, I've listened to some of the video and some of the things about your thoughts on AI advocacy. The Trump administration recently, just March 2026, released their plan. And I think there's some similarities in that, and I think we both believe here, is that there's a risk in having a lot of states do their own regulations as opposed to more of a federal roadmap for how we legislate around AI, and that is in some ways potentially the ideal way. I don't know if you have any thoughts there.
I have so many. AI is the technology of the era that will define us. There's no question. You've made that point. And there's different flavors of AI. You know, AI has been flying planes for a long time. So, and there's factory automation, there's robotics, humanoid robotics. There's so many different things where humanoid or pets that are robots. Yes. There's a lot of great things that AI is doing, and it'll do a lot more. But my career, you're right, has been from the beginning, starting with the legality of the VCR, the getting of the PC, high-definition television, focus on the internet itself, working on the literally global laws now that allowed commerce on the internet, because remember, it wasn't allowed in the beginning, as well as now going into AI and self-driving vehicles and robotics and quantum and other things where there's so many things that are obviously coming. And there is a, I don't want to call it a battle, but there's a race among nations, and it'll be determined whose economies do better and maybe even what languages your kids end up speaking. Because this is a hugely important battle that's fought out. And other countries have national AI plans and or self-driving. And we are like, there was self-driving, we can't get to the Congress because the trial lawyers, they live off of carnage. And it's a huge industry of 40,000 people a year dying and 2 million people hospitalized because of avoidable vehicle accidents. We could end that, almost all of it. But the trial lawyers effectively killed a bill 6 years ago in the Senate, and they're stopping a national plan. And now in AI...
If I could just like interrupt you real quick, The thing about autonomous vehicles that gets me is what you said earlier. AI and space is fully autonomous. You're not piloting a spaceship. The thing is flying itself on autopilot. Airlines are, for the most part, they run on autopilot.
90%, 95% of the time, it's autopilot.
They land and they take off. Everything else is generally autopilot. Yet, autonomous vehicles, especially on the highway and the freeways, that is still a thing where we haven't been able to agree on. I know that there's legislation in front of D.C. and Maryland right now about whether or not Waymo and other autonomous vehicles can live on the streets, and is yet to be a push to make that happen.
It's insanity. It really is, because it's not only a matter of cutting healthcare costs, helping cut the debt and deficit, and saving a lot of people's lives and injuries. And we've all lost loved ones and friends that we know because of these things are avoidable now. And not that it empowers disabled people, empowers older people, it saves energy. It could save on the actual cost of the cars, because if you don't have all these driver controls in a car, you take out a lot of the cost of a car.
Maybe like an AM radio?
Well, what you're referring to is AM radio is the broadcasters using government to save their dying business is they are pushing for a mandate in every car that gets an AM radio. It's kind of silly because it's such a silly issue. We started over 100 years ago as a radio manufacturers association. I think we're the only association in the history of Washington that's fighting them. Oh, wow, the government mandate your products. No, we don't want it mandated. We believe in free market, and we believe that, you know, their argument about emergencies and safety is just bull, because most of the AM radio stations probably don't even have people in them manning. They're just repeaters. And second of all, the last emergency broadcast we measured, and 99% of the people got it through their smartphone. They didn't get it through a radio, even FM or AM. But you could also get it through satellite, there's CB radios, there's telephones. There's a whole bunch of different ways to communicate in an emergency. And so it's just a made-up story because AM radio has gone to the tanker. And they want to preserve it. And you know what? It will be preserved. We said, look, car manufacturers are going to give it in rural areas for a while. Farmers do rely on it somewhat for reports and things like that. But this is a marketplace of multimedia. This isn't, you know, this isn't the life-saving equipment anymore. But the different things that the products that are introduced and efforts like self-driving. And now we're seeing with AI. And you mentioned 50 states, 50. There's been over 2,000 pieces of legislation introduced in the states in the last 15 or 16 months. And that is debilitating to startups. This is where big companies have the advantage. And God bless big companies. We have almost every one of them is a member of ours, but 80% of our companies are smaller companies. And as a fundamental cultural imperative for our organization, we want startups. We want entrepreneurs. We give a break to the exhibitors of the CES that are startups, because we want them there to expose their ideas to the 7,000 journalists, the tens of thousands of retailers, the investors, the partners, and the big guys. Because you know what? The big guys want to invest in. They want to be the first customer for it. They want to help finance the small guys because they want to learn. They recognize that's where innovation is occurring. It's the fundamental, basic secret sauce of the United States is that we encourage innovation and challenging the status quo more than any other country. And it comes from our culture. It comes from the fact that, you know, there's so many people that came here that are immigrants. It also came from the fact that we have a First Amendment that allows you to say what you want and push back on government. When the broadcasters are trying to protect their rice ball, you just push back because they're doing it again. They're doing it in all sorts of different ways. They want a TV tuner standard. They want a TV tuner in every video screen you buy so they could get a signal. They're just pushing and fighting because they give the members of Congress free airtime to do charitable causes so they could get in there. And that's, you know, look, they're in every district and we're fighting them.
You might say, but like bureaucracy and fear is the thing that prevents innovation from happening in some ways.
Bureaucracy is stultifying. I mean, I go to France a lot, and you know, I'm a huge fan of President Macron because he really believes in entrepreneurship and innovation. He created a third party called La Marche Forward, which was all about technology and innovation. He made his pitch at CES in Las Vegas 2 years in a row, and he is in there in office, and he's fighting. But as I give a lot of speeches in France, and I can't resist saying, you know, entrepreneur is a French word, but so is bureaucrat. So they understand that about themselves, but they do have a lot of good things going for them. But Europe itself is, you know, you want to talk about AI. So part of AI is enormous data sets. That goes against some, and should, against privacy principles that we share. We share with the Europeans. They're definitely more like, they're like everything. You could erase your own history on the internet by law. We're more balanced. China's the other way. China has 1.3 billion health records in one agency, and they could use AI and draw every possible correlation, and they're going to figure out how to treat people. It's a very homogeneous society. We look different. We have so many differences in so many different ways. They're not like that, but they are going to be ahead of us on AI because they have no privacy at all. And they really are going after AI. They're producing AI engineers and scientists en masse. Like, we can't keep up. Remember, China has more people than the US and Europe together multiplied by 4. So they just, it's a numbers game with them. It's like they're Olympic athletes. You know, you get enough people and then you get the best and you're gonna win a lot of Olympic medals. And especially if, you know, you don't have human rights as they don't in China the way we do. So what we try to do is we're like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, you know. We don't want the porridge too hot. We don't want it too cold. We want it just right. And that's what privacy and balancing against innovation. We want to be reasonable. And that's really important. And I can give a lot of examples where we haven't been the way we should. I see that a lot because of in healthcare, especially my wife's a surgeon and she does research. She's an inventor. And I see how sometimes privacy is so high that you get rid of progress and you don't save lives. And that's not a good thing.
So I'm going to shift gears here for a second. CES. One of my favorite things, I think I've been to 7, 8. And one of the things that I find that is the most amazing about CES is like it's like a slow time lapse. You see something that seems like an idea, maybe with a small business or entrepreneur, and then you come back and they have a slightly bigger booth. And then 3 years later, it's like 15 companies who are doing the thing. And then it just like, it keeps growing.
No, but then it shrinks sometimes because too many companies are doing the same thing.
This is true. I saw that with glasses. It's like everybody had glasses and then suddenly not as many people had glasses, you know, but maybe they're back. Apple's going to have them, you know, of course Meta has them. But I'm wondering, like, is this a thing that you felt from 35 years of CESs of just watching these little things grow and turn into sometimes really big ideas?
Yes, and I've also seen funny things because I remember there's this one Japanese company, Sanyo Fisher, that put in its display case surrounded by glass. At that time, impossible to create camcorder. It's tiny. And everyone was photographing the whole show, and I asked the CEO what that was about. He said, we just wanted to drive people crazy. But you know, but people didn't realize it wasn't possible. Because that's what Sanyo Fisher thought. But actually, they made it possible because they were taking pictures of it. But no, yeah, there's a tremendous amount of innovation that occurs across many different lines. Some of them, you know, they're throwing up against the wall to see what succeeds. Some of them are great ideas, but not the right time. I think you mentioned glasses is a great example of that. For example, when Google Glass was first being prototyped, it had facial recognition tied in with Facebook. And I thought that was great for someone like me who can't remember anyone's names. And I meet literally thousands of people a year and I just can't remember. Like, I need that. And in the Washington environment, a lot of us need that. But all of a sudden there was a couple of privacy articles. This is an invasion of privacy. And oh my God. And they pulled it and it was dead for like 10 years. But now it's coming back. I mean, people with Alzheimer's, other people that are visually impaired, they're going blind or they are blind. Why can't they have that? These are great things. And when you go out in the street, if you want to cover up your face, you can do that. People wear masks all the time now for various reasons. But the law is very clear that once you go in public, you give up a certain amount of privacy, whether it's the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure, is if you have something in plain view or your photo, if it's not used for commercial purposes, you do give up certain rights. And then there's a balancing of rights in this country. But we should always balance in the favor of, we don't have to go to government to ask for permission to build something unless it's like a nuclear bomb or something like that. It's really inherently dangerous. But we don't want to be one of those countries where the government is telling us what we can build and we can't build, or we won't be competitive in the world.
There was a talk that I gave maybe a few months ago, and I mentioned that things feel either bad or just weird until it becomes invisible and normal. There was a point that having AirPods or buds, you know, it was a strange thing, or it was not acceptable to walk up into a restaurant, maybe still that, with AirPods in your ear, or holding a phone all the time, or, you know, now glasses with cameras. But there's this weird place where something goes from awkward to acceptable, and then it's just acceptable. And I say this as a person who will wear an Apple Vision Pro on a flight and just, you know, sit and zone out in the world.
Yeah. Well, you know, I agree with everything you're saying, but I want to add, sometimes it's not acceptable, but sometimes it's the opposite. It's a status symbol. The red Beats headphones were a status symbol. And even, let's be honest, the white, they don't have to be white AirPods. But yet, that signified for a long time that was Apple's thing. Now anyone can produce white. It's about status. You go to 0-60 pretty much the same in any car, and there are certain comfort things and safety things, but a lot of cars are, you're trying to send a message to the world about who you are.
Yes. Good point. Good point. All right, so back to that seeing technology over this time lapse. The thing that I have noticed over the last few years is robotics. And you mentioned China and China being ahead in some ways in AI. The number of companies with different pieces of robotics from design to manufacturing, the number of hands, arms, bodies, all the things, it was the first time that I realized, wow, we are at this point of seeing a leap to general purpose robotics in a way that the cost is coming down, that there are more people producing and building. I think CTA did a white paper on robotics that talks about just some of the things that are happening. I'm curious, and of course, I should also add, NVIDIA's keynote on physical AI, which robotics, I would say, is a subset, but this is sensors, cameras, cars, anything that is artificial intelligence and robotics or sensing physical devices attached.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, self-driving car is a robot, absolutely. I mean, and it's pretty complex because there's a lot of safety involved and you have to detect whether it's a ball or a kid or an animal. I mean, there's so many different things you have to do. And we've done great as a country. We're almost there. But yeah, at CES, we had over 50 robotics exhibitors and we expect more. It's clear. I grew up reading science fiction. That's why I love this stuff, because this is CES and other events are like science fiction coming to life. And not everything's going to happen that way. I mean, there's a lot of weird things in science fiction. You know, I love Star Trek, but you know, I don't think I'm going to live to see teleportation. I'd like to, but robots are weird, are definitely a success thing, and they'll be very unusual and different from each other. So there's a lot of categories of robotics. Some of them are comfort. Some of them are for safety. Some of them for industry. Some of them are for tasks to save things. You know, there's a lot in the food area of food preparation now. There's robotic restaurants. There's robotic servers. There's robotics delivering things all around now. George Mason University, the campus, they're one of the very first to have robotic delivery of pizza. And this is like at least 10 years ago. There's a lot of going on all over the country and the world in robotics. And we're still doing the baby steps now. And there's ethical issues that come up with AI and with robotics, and we have to deal with them. But the things I've been involved in, like the internet, HDTV, other areas, is where we have to define a national goal and say, this is what we want. And then once you agree with the government and industry national goal, you will get there, because there'll be a process of discovery, of evaluation, of experimentation. And the marketplace itself has to determine what ultimately is, unless there's a reason, like the government, when, for example, we stay away from national security issues for the most part. But you know how they do what they do in defense, they have all sorts of reasons for doing it the way they do it and requiring it built in the U.S. The challenge we're facing is that more and more, like with self-driving cars, we're defined as connected cars as a national defense issue, and then drones as a defense issue. And now there's this proceeding out there on wireless routers as a defense issue. And some of the defense things, when you try to understand, they're very difficult. I mean, drones is very clear. I mean, look what's going on in the Mideast and how important drones are there. Self-driving vehicles, and whether you're, you know, I remember when the Y2K was coming, the concern was like everything would turn off. And then I remember there was a guy who said, chips and products, senior government official, this is terrible. You know, your coffee maker with one chip in it, it's going to revolt and start spewing coffee at you. I mean, there's been a lot. The thing about technology is that people think it's going to take over the world and hurt you. And unless it's specifically programmed to do so, it's not likely to do that. But there are legitimate issues of cybersecurity and there are concerns. And our job as an organization, which you referred to earlier, is to make sure that public policy, in a way, is welcoming to innovation, but sets the necessary guardrails to protect citizen safety, which are important. And it's also important for manufacturers and service providers to know what's legal and what's not legal. And what's happened lately is that Congress and administration, in the interest of compromise, sometimes they get lazy and they don't define what's legal. And the reason there's so many freaking lawyers around is because they're helping determine in courts what's legal and what's not illegal. And for innovative companies, it's deadly once a lawsuit's filed, especially for startups, because they'll lose their funding right away and they can't get additional rounds of funding. And some of that is because even some of the biggest companies on Wall Street, and even some with ties to the administration, are patent troll friendly. And people buy up dead patents, and then they just issue threatening letters, and they make money. And now they basically sell this as a bundled package, as you could buy, you know, a piece of this patent trolling thing. And that's devastating to innovation. So there's a lot of things which we're fighting on and we're not succeeding on. Litigation costs, patent trolls, all sorts of things. One thing the U.S. does fairly well is we have a bright and flexible workforce, that where we have people that could share in the profits. We have a lot, like if you take NVIDIA as a company, which is clearly one of the most successful, Jensen Huang, who came into this building the very first time he was in Washington and spoke to our staff. I wish I listened more carefully and bought his stock, because he laid out his vision. He basically, he has many, many multimillionaires among like several thousand of his employees.
Not only are they the most valuable company, they're also one of the smallest, most valuable companies. I think the smallest has ever existed. And I will fact check and make sure I put these in the show notes just to make sure. But I'm sure there are a lot of millionaires there.
I think some of the platforms are getting, I mean, like ChatGPT and others are relatively small. And yeah, but you're right. I mean, but he had a vision of chips being in self-driving cars and in video games. And I think the third thing was high-resolution monitors, perhaps, or something else. And all three of those hit. And now, I mean, and he doesn't give up. He's relentless. He gave a keynote at CES a year ago. He also spoke this year. But like he was on stage by himself for an hour and a half speaking with barely any notes or screens or anything. Nobody else came on stage except to hand him stuff. And then Kinsey Fabrizio, our president, who will soon be CEO, came on rather backstage with me. And he kept talking to us for 20 minutes. The guy is like passionate. He doesn't do anything but like on weekends, like I'll get a note or a text from him. The guy is passionate about his work and he has a vision. He's like certain individuals like Steve Jobs and Elon Musk and Donald Trump that are so, or Michael Dell, they're just so focused on their what they believe in that they're very successful in different ways.
So you mentioned Kinsey, and I feel like this is probably a great time to ask another question about pivoting. Because, I guess the question is, what advice are you going to take from your own book as you're about to pivot from being CEO to now the executive chairman?
I am executive chairman. I have been since January 1. So, yeah, the first thing is we have a one-hour meeting at CES, and we have 55 people that speak, and you still have to end it on time. And that was my first test. So I survived the first test. No, the job of a CEO is to run the organization. I've done that since 1991. As I told my board 5 years ago, I'm ready to stop. This whole transition to Kinsey has been at least five years. Her name was named in our succession planning a long time ago. She's a star. She's smart. She's empathetic. She's articulate. She's a great manager. She loves creating new things. She has what it needs to take the organization to the next level. I felt, first of all, you know, at some point, as my kids have let me know, I do have to spend some time with my family. And also, I've climbed every mountain that I could visually see and climb. And I think I'm at the point where of giving back nonprofit work, speaking on some for-profit boards, doing other things. I do a lot of mentoring of especially, believe it or not, female executives that are going places. And I get a lot out of that. So I'm ready for something different. And I want Kinsey to succeed, but I also care so much and I have so much institutional history, I want to be there for her. So our board and Kinsey and I agreed on this executive chairman thing for a while. It'll, I think, carry me and give me the taste. But I do not want to be Robert Iger of Disney to have your handpicked successor come in there and then you cut him off of the knee. So at this point, I think I've been really well behaved, but she's not giving me any reason not to be. But I think she'll do great, and I want to be there. As I told her, I'm always there a phone call away. But I realize also, and since I've dealt with so many CEOs and I've seen them, how they transition out, and I see what they do. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I realize that a lot of, I'll give you a positive example, is that President Bush and President Obama spoke to each other frequently, even though they were in office at the same time, but they would call each other and they'd get advice from each other. And not that Kinsey and I are different political parties, but the point is it does happen in a very positive way because the CEO position is a very lonely position and no one really knows what you're going through because the people that work for you, as much as you love them and like them, they're not your friends because you're in a power relationship over them. So you have to be able to talk to other people. I've been very blessed that as opposed to some association executives that approach the boards as enemies, my board has been chosen not because they're great guys, which I hate when a nominating committee talks about that, but because they fill gaps and needs and I could bring my biggest problems and they could help solve them. So that's been a very important relationship, and I want to continue that culture on the board to make sure we get people on the board that could come from different backgrounds, different companies, different categories, different size of companies, different parts of the world or country, and bring different viewpoints. So we'll have what it takes is you need a strong CEO and you need a strong board. The chairman's role, frankly, is to make sure every board member is heard. The board approves the overall strategic direction of the company, and the CEO's role is to run the company and come up with ideas collegially with the board and the budget. And we, by every definition, we've been very lucky. I'll say luck is a large part of our success. You know, we caught this thing called industry, and we have a CES, and we've always gotten new things and grown it. And we've been definitely, by every measure, one of the most successful organizations in Washington. And we want to continue that, but we need Kinsey to take it to the next level.
What I'm hearing is that you're expecting that Kinsey's going to keep inviting you to CES even after you maybe retire from being a chairman.
I think I qualify to go as a former chairman, so I am. There. I've never thought of it that way, but I will if
okay.
you want. But I hope I'd be
I'm
devastated.
Sure, there's no way that she would. All right, last question. 2027 for CES, where should I eat next year?
Where should you eat?
Yeah, what's your favorite place? I'm sure you spend a lot of time in Vegas with CES. Don't you have like some, I assume that you're like Vegas royalty at this point and have spent a lot of time across the city. So I figured I had to ask for some last minute recommendations before I left.
So the truth is, I'm like the prettiest girl in high school that doesn't get asked to the prom. So first of all, I don't get a lot of invites, but there's a lot of things I do have to go to. And I'll go to like 3, 4, 5, 6 different events in one night. But no, I don't go to dinners except at our own dinner. And I have a dinner with my brothers after the show's over because they like to go there and play poker and it's their opportunity to get together. But no, I very rarely go to a Las Vegas restaurant, to be perfectly honest. I go to events, and that's what I do. So I try to remember the last time I was in a Las Vegas restaurant. We'll have a little dinner on the third night of the show for some of our key board members at Kinsey and I will host at a good hotel restaurant. And don't ask me which ones, because it's all about availability.
I understand.
And plus, they're all my, you know, it's like choosing your favorite kid.
Gary is now the executive chair of CTA, and it's been wonderful having you on
Thank
the show.
You. Thank you for having me.
Before we go, when I think of competition, I often picture in my head marathon or a race. And last week in Beijing, robots did just that. They competed in a half marathon. Humans ran alongside humanoid robots on a parallel course, and a robot won. And when I say this, a robot didn't just win the robot race, it beat the human world record. A humanoid robot called Lightning, built by the Chinese smartphone company Honor, ran a 13.1-mile course in 50 minutes and 26 seconds. The human world record is 57 minutes. To put that in perspective, last year was the first time they did this race. Only 6 of 21 robots even finished. The winner took 2 hours and 40 minutes. In 1 year, they went from barely standing up to outrunning the fastest humans on Earth. So robots, who are beating humans in races now, well, what's the worst that could happen, right? All right, folks, that's Thoughts on Tech and Things for the week. Let me know your thoughts by leaving me a message in the WIPR app, calling 410-735-1616, or find me at jasonmperry.com. Thanks to the team at WIPR, our producer, Shania Mapson, and Perry Labs Head of Operations and Marketing, Myrna Martinez. New episodes drop every other week. I'm Jason Michael Perry. This is Thoughts on Tech and Things, and I'll see you next time.